I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. When anxiety about Asia rises, it can be our memory that gets knocked out first. Barack Obama, as president 4 years ago, announced a pivot to Asia, barely noting that we'd been there before, in Vietnam, in his lifetime. But even principals in the Vietnam War had a way of forgetting not just the facts, but what they'd said about them. John Kennedy sent fighting men into Vietnam as president, but as a studious young senator, he had seen the folly of doing just that.
The reason why the war in Indochina has not had the support of the people of that area and the people of Asia has been that the French have maintained too great a degree of control over the lives of the people. I therefore believe that before the United States moves in any degree, that independence must be granted to the people, that the people must support the struggle.
Here's President Kennedy in 1963.
We've invested a tremendous amount of effort, and it's going quite well. I do realize, of course, and we all have to realize, that Vietnam has been in war for 20 years. We want to see a stable government there carrying on a struggle to maintain its national independence. We believe strongly in that. We're not going to withdraw from that effort. In my opinion, for us to withdraw from that effort would mean a collapse not only of South Vietnam, but Southeast Asia. So we're going to stay there.
In 2017, we're there again in Asia, transformed. Our anxiety indexes fix on many points. Those man-made islands, trade debts and deficits, a truly scary nuclear threat that's just about all we know about North Korea. The deeper anxiety may be founded, as it was in Vietnam time, on sheer dread of China. Its wealth and power grown 100-fold in just the last half century. You'll hear the case this hour that the whole world is being Easternized, also that the U.S. and China are together at the edge of a historic trap set for great powers that meet on the staircase, one rising, one in decline. But the through line this hour is history, with a master of it. Our guest, Frederick Loggeval, wrote two big books that took me prisoner this spring. The first was Choosing War, about the last chance for peace in Vietnam 5 decades ago. And then the backstory, Embers of War, which won the Pulitzer Prize, about how the U.S. snatched a losing war from the jaws of France's imperial defeat in Indochina in the 1950s. Fred Loggeval, welcome. It's a positively insane-making saga you've written. And we'll get to the criminal foolishness, the lying, the euphemisms, death, destruction, and defeat doesn't stop it. I'd love to just start with the JFK case because he still gets our hopes up. 1951, young congressman. Even before that clip, he goes to Vietnam on his own and he sees it all in his diary. Seymour Topping, of the AP, Edmund Gullion, young staff guy in the State Department. And he realizes it's a French puppet government, the enemy of its people, who would vote for the communists if they had a chance. And then 1961, 10 years later, he's bought the Cardinal Spellman and the Pentagon line, although he still knows better. How do you explain that pattern?
Well, the clip that you played, the two clips that you played, are absolutely fascinating to me. And, you know, I've struggled with this question about JFK because there is a paradox, because, as you say, he arrives in 1951 with Bobby and Patricia, and he sees through the French expressions of bravado because they try to suggest to young Jack, we're winning this war and we will win. And you can see, as you say in his diary, you can see in what he says to various Boston audiences when he returns. Right. He's not buying any of it. And I think he realizes even then in 51 that any Western power, not just the French, any Western power is going to struggle to overcome Ho Chi Minh's revolution or any comparable revolution by anybody else. And yet, as you say, the paradox. This same Kennedy escalates U.S. involvement as president. And that's what we have to grapple with.
He remembered that guy, Ed Gullion, from the State Department. He made him his ambassador, a very personal gesture to the Congo at a critical time when he walks into office. But he forgets or something. What is your own hindsight on that pattern getting repeated and repeated, even unto today? We'll come to today. But I mean, in the Vietnam case, what kept that awful thing going.
Well, I think what happens with Kennedy, and then it happens later with Johnson, and I think it happens with Nixon, is that it becomes an issue of credibility. And credibility we often think of as a national concept. That is to say, we talk about U.S. credibility on the world stage. And I think that's partly what's going on. But in addition to that, for Kennedy and Johnson, and maybe in particular, it's also about partisan credibility and personal credibility. And so I think they become attached to the idea that U.S. prestige and credibility is at stake here, but also the Democratic Party's credibility and their own. And they become, even though Kennedy in particular, I think never loses that sense of apprehension. He keeps upping the ante.
But you wonder, I think a word like credibility is a sort of invention or construction. They had FDR to fall back on. In your book, and this is where I've learned more than anything about this, FDR was solid that the French were not going to get the colonies back. He fought with de Gaulle about it. He fought with Churchill about it. Yeah. And, you know, England wasn't going to hang on to India either. It's over. That period is over. The credibility of our country would be a lot bigger if Kennedy had seen it the other way, right?
Oh, there's no question about this. And FDR, I think that transition between FDR and Truman, those one of those what-ifs in history, matters a great deal. Because Truman did not care in the same way about these things as FDR did, and he let the French go in. I do think, however, that for the Democrats in particular, domestic politics, that dimension of credibility, actually, rightly or wrongly, and I would say wrongly, had a great deal of importance for them, and it was that deadly fear of being perceived as and being called soft on communism. This is something that comes through in David Halberstam's great book, The Best and the Brightest, that these Democrats, more so than Republicans, had to worry about what they would be called if they did not stand firm in Vietnam. Now, I also think on the great what if, had Kennedy survived, I don't think we'd see a large-scale American war in Vietnam. I do think he was different from Johnson in this regard.
David Halberstam, we're all remembering 10 years after his death, a giant. And that book was an incredibly important lesson learned for millions of readers. But there's another lesson learned that I want you to talk about. That was H.R. McMaster, Dereliction of Duty. Yeah. He's another West Point PhD historian like David Petraeus. And he's now at the right hand of President Trump. Yeah. Dereliction of Duty made a very tough-minded case that the Joint Chiefs of Staff failed the country in not talking straight to presidents during the Vietnam period. You knew him in graduate school.
I did.
Tell us about him.
Well, so we met. We were in different graduate programs. We met in 1992, I believe, both working on our respective dissertations, which became our first books. And we met at the Johnson Library in Austin, and I liked him from the get-go. He's warm, he's generous, he's a good listener, he's got a wonderful laugh. And so what's happened over the ensuing years is that we've kept in periodic contact. Ironically, I saw him not long before he was appointed as National Security Advisor because he was potentially coming to a position at the Kennedy School. So we saw each other.
Wow.
And it's funny how life works, because he might be on his way to an appointment at the Kennedy School, and instead he's now National Security Advisor of the
United States. And he's already nudged Steve Bannon out of the National Security Council, and he seems to have control over his personnel. What's to expect?
Well, I think what's interesting about him is that there's lots interesting about him, and I should say that I'm very pleased that he was appointed to this position. He has, I think, and it's clear from his own writings, it's clear from his actions, as a military commander, I think he has a sense of history. He has a sense of the contingencies of history, the potential irrationality of human affairs, and he's also not been shy about criticizing the military. This is interesting. Criticizing the military for its overemphasis on technological superiority. He's shown that time and time again. So that's on the one side, and that gives me a sense that he's a guy who will see the complexity of so many of these world problems. On the other side, I think one would say that he is somebody who accepts, I think quite wholeheartedly, the proposition that the United States should be a hegemonic world power, that the United States is operating in a world with existential threats to its security. You can speak, in a sense, about a good versus evil approach, a sense in which the military instrument of American power has to be used. And so it's going to be interesting to see. I don't want to speak it necessarily in terms of a kind of tug of war within H.R. McMaster, but it'll be interesting to see which sides of him take precedence, if I can.
I want to know what kinds of questions he could challenge, both to the military culture and to the Trump culture, such as that is. I mean, that of a gold-plated real estate tycoon from New York City, and even speaking man to man, would he? I didn't get the sense from his book, and I read it 10 years ago, Dereliction of Duty, that he would say, "Mr. President, do you realize that we're killing 100 to 1 Vietnamese for each one of ours, and they're mostly civilians?" I mean, could he deal with not only moral and strategic questions at once in a briefing?
I want to say that he could, and I believe that he could, knowing him as I do. You're quite right that if one judges the book and some of his other writings, I don't think this has been in the forefront of his concern. It's not something that he, let's say, chastised the military chiefs at the time of the Vietnam escalation for. Mm-hmm. He called them guilty he said that they were derelict, that this was a dereliction of
duty.
That's
a strong word for men still in uniform today, right?
No, it is true, and I think perhaps it's had an effect on his subsequent military career, his willingness to do this. Whether he would go to the extent that you're suggesting is an open question.
Well, I mean, even just man to man, Mr. Trump, I have a funny feeling that Trump could take it.
I think he could.
Frederick Logevall, Pulitzer Prize historian of Vietnam, looking forward in Asia, is our guest. Coming up, there is a line out there, history's logic, or maybe just another lazy excuse to have a war, the line that says, when a power as big as China rises, or as big as ours matures, they're bound to fight about it. That's next. This is Open Source, with the historian Frederick Logevall on the modern roots of our Trump-era anxiety in Asia. President Xi Jinping says it publicly now that there is a Thucydides trap lying open for China and the United States, the trap named for the immortal historian of the wars that destroyed ancient Greece. In Thucydides' judgment, 5th century BC, it was the rise of Athens and the fear that instilled in Sparta that made their war inevitable. It was the Harvard scholar Graham Allison who called it Thucydides' trap and put it on the cover of The Atlantic magazine 2 summers ago, and now on the cover of a book, he wrote it, titled Destined for War. He walked me through the idea this week.
The Thucydides' trap says when a rising power threatens to displace a ruling power, stuff happens, mainly bad stuff. So when a rising power like China threatens to displace the U.S., historically, that pattern, business as usual, leads to history as usual, and that history is more often war than peace.
It's the war part that makes me want to push back. I mean, there are other instances that you don't specially cite, including the United States and the EU, which has more people and more product today than we do, and it was never remotely on the war charts. The United States and China for 40 years is certainly an argument that we've helped them. We've become a kind of status quo partnership, nuclear powers both, but makers and takers, bankers and us. To have a war with China, we'd have to borrow the money from them to fight it.
Yes.
Why do we put it in military terms?
Well, because if we look at the last 500 years of history, 16 times a rising power threatens to displace a ruling power. In 12 of these, the outcome is war. In 4, not war. So war is not inevitable.
What do you do with the rising American empire and the fading British empire in the 1890s?
One of the 4 success stories is the rise of the U.S. to surpass Britain in the 1880s, 90s, and into the 20th century, and that required huge adjustment. The behavior of the U.S. from the British point of view looked pretty threatening. The British, nonetheless, had a rising Germany, even closer to home. So they found ways to adapt and adjust. Two countries that are economically very thickly interwoven. The leaders of them are all cousins. They vacation together. Nonetheless, under those conditions, an event like the assassination of an archduke, which would otherwise be inconsequential or manageable, allows one thing to lead to the other, like a striking of a match that creates a fire. And so I say, wake up. This is a highly risky situation, not predetermined, not foreordained, but if we just do business as usual, we could end up with history as usual. And after the fact, nobody would think a war between the U.S. and China was a good idea. They would say it was insane. It would be insane.
Graham, I read Thucydides. I wonder if you partially quote him and get him wrong. This was an over-the-hill general, but overall a peacenik historian.
Right.
When you speak of inevitability, and you call your book Destined for War, I think you're missing a tragic anti-war strain that runs deep in Thucydides.
I agree completely with your interpretation of Thucydides. Classical Greece was one of the great steeples of civilization. And Thucydides absolutely was horrified by the fact that this war had been allowed to happen. And you can even see a strain of deep resentment of Pericles. Pericles was the greatest statesman, according to Thucydides. And he was. He had negotiated a 30-year peace to deal, and this is one strategy for dealing with a rising power and a ruling power, just let's agree to some terms and constraints on the competition. The peace had held for 15 years. Thucydides' account of this, I think, is brilliant from a peace-oriented point of view, not to say war is a good thing. He thought it was horrible. At the end of it, the parties are all destroyed.
The Thucydides line I would put on my book was the line that the state that separates its thinkers, its scholars, from its warriors will have its thinking done by cowards and its fighting done by fools. That's what I take away from the man today. Watch out, but get the thinking, long-range historians into this conversation.
I agree. I would say that unless thinking Americans can think a little bit historically about how conditions that were deeply dangerous, led to wars nobody wanted, and that were catastrophic for them, we will end up doing business as usual. How could this have happened? How insane was this to happen?
That's Graham Allison. He was the first dean at the Kennedy School at Harvard, and he wrote his first big book on the Cuban Missile Crisis of 1962. Frederick Logoval, historian, child of Thucydides, always referred to as the father of modern history. What's your line on the trap?
Well, I think that Graham has produced a sweeping book that's going to get a lot of attention. And I think what's great about this is that it's forcing us to think about long history, deep history, as it pertains to the present. And I think several of the cases that he discusses are especially illuminating. The one for me that I think maybe has the most resonance today might be the rise of Japan in the first half of the last century, in which you see Japan challenging both Britain and the United States.
First
in
Russia.
Which, yes, but in particular here, I think what's salient for me perhaps is the two Western powers here. And a rivalry becomes, of course, ultimately a war. And it's in some ways an economic competition that then is transformed into a military competition and ultimately results in war. That's the one that I think about the most when I think about the trap. Does this mean that we're destined to have a war? Not at all. It seems to me that, and Graham is quite right to suggest that this is not by any means preordained. But I do think that it's useful to think about this longer history that in this book he causes us to look at.
Well, I'm still not clear whether it's a warning or a self-fulfilling prophecy, something like the domino theory that we heard a lot about, you know, in Eisenhower, early Kennedy time in Vietnam. Mm-hmm. I mean, when you say it's a trap, get your dukes up, be prepared for a war.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, and it, I don't think, however, that's the thrust of the argument that he wants to make. I think he, as I read the book, he's suggesting that what's important here is for China, both Chinese and American leaders, to have communication, to understand each other's needs and, yeah. And challenges, and for the Americans in this case, as the leading power, to accommodate to some extent to the rise of China in various respects. But I don't see the trap as being one that one can't get out of.
No, exactly. But how would we go about it? How would we signal that, you know, for all our bragging about being a Pacific nation, we see you, we know you, we can imagine you running the toll booths, you know, in the Malacca Straits and managing the traffic.
Well, I you know, I think you're right to give us a cautionary note, Chris, because certainly looking at the 20th century history and looking at U.S. relations with that part of the world, beginning in a serious way with the war against the Philippines, it's not a very salutary, you know, lesson to draw from that set of involvements. And the United States has shown a lamentable tendency to reach for, to pursue the military option.
Exactly what I
mean. And that's clearly going to be a danger here again. I would say, and maybe this is important in terms of the trap and its utility, that in the nuclear age, which is what we're now in, I personally find it harder to imagine that China and the United States as nuclear powers go to war. The bigger threat, it seems to me, is that a skirmish, if you will, something smaller but involves the use of the respective militaries, let's say in the South China Sea, leads through a series of escalations to something much bigger and much more unpredictable. That's the thing that worries me more than any kind of large-scale military confrontation from the start.
Do you believe what they tell us about how eager all those other friendly states on the rim of Asia are for our presence, to keep our eye and a menacing eye on China?
That's my sense. You know, as a historian, I don't have an in-depth knowledge of where those countries are now. But my, you know, what I'm gathering is that one of the reasons why they approved many of those nations, the Obama pivot, and why they felt that it was something that would benefit them was precisely because of this concern over the rise, over the aggressive actions as they saw it that China was taking, especially with respect to the South China Sea, but also in other respects, and that if in fact Obama meant what he said, and that this was going to represent now a focused attention from the Americans, it was a good thing for them, I think they believed.
We're going to come back to the matter of the pivot, I hope.
Yeah.
But I'm just struck, even speaking with Graham, but thinking about the whole picture, that China is in a class by itself as a state out there, now more than ever, as a real economic sibling, if not superior of ours. And it, I don't know, in the 50s into the 60s, when China was a poor, desperately poor country, it was seen as dangerous.
Yeah.
At least we called it dangerous. And now that they're rich and unbelievably middle class and neoliberal and, you know, more cell phones on their subways than on ours kind of thing, there's still a sense of we're going to have to teach them a lesson or something.
Yeah. No, I think that's true. I would say a couple things about this. I think in the 50s and 60s, behind closed doors, and maybe this is especially true of the 60s, behind closed doors, I think American strategists, presidents, decision makers, secretaries of state and defense were less concerned, I think, about the Chinese threat. In other words, this was in part for public consumption. I think they understood what you said, which is that this is a weak power. At most, it's going to be a regional threat, but we don't have to be too concerned about its challenge to our supremacy. And I guess I would also say that I give Obama, since he's just left office, we can talk about him a little bit, I give him a certain amount of credit because, after all, U.S.-China relations were, in geopolitical terms at least, quite tranquil during the 8 years of Barack Obama. That suggests that, again, whatever American officials might be saying and whatever fear-mongering they might be engaging in, Cooler heads, it seems to me, at least in the recent past, have prevailed. Question now being, can that continue under our 45th, our new president?
What do you think?
Well, you know, I want to come back to the history point for a minute, because one of my concerns about him is that he appears to have no historical sensibility, really, to speak of.
I love it when you talk historical sensibility, historical imagination.
Yeah.
That's your charm for me. What is he missing?
Well, I think, you know, I don't want to suggest that history has great predictive power. I'm a professional historian. I know all too well that we historians often are quite poor at predicting what's going to happen. I do, however, want to insist that that's precisely in a sense, or we need to study more history. We need to know our history, because history can make us, it can pull us out of our self-centeredness. It can thereby make us more aware of the likely effects of our actions. And that, it seems to me, is the beginning of maturity and wisdom. That's what history can do. And I worry that this particular president, who by his own admission doesn't really read, does not seem to have much interest in this great American story that he is entering, on some level seems to live in the thrall of an eternal present, won't have that sensibility. A sense, maybe another way of putting it is a sense for the possible and the probable in human affairs. And that's what historical sensibility, it seems to me, brings.
Two things yours does for me is sort of uncovering those layers of planning that are much, much deeper than the political conversation in Vietnam, for example. But also to separate out, as we were saying, the contingencies from the continuities, the continuities that are Tolstoyan but virtually unexplainable. They're never covered in the newspapers, but the big trends culturally and now weather-wise, migration, feeling, religion, resurgence of spirit, blah, blah, blah. Apply that to this moment.
Well, this is what we historians do all the time, and we debate this among ourselves. How do we discuss, both with our students in class and also in our own work, this relationship between structure, which is what you're describing here, and human agency? How do the two connect? And I think that the best history tries to do that. Where do leaders, individual leaders, actually make a difference? I am among those historians who believe that individuals make a great difference. And we can look at, you know, many instances in the recent past when that matters. It matters, for example, it seems to me that George W. Bush took office in 2001 rather than Al Gore. I don't think that under Al Gore we have an invasion of Iraq in March of 2003. I think they saw that particular conflict differently. As I suggested earlier, I think that the FDR-Truman transition in terms of Indochina and in terms of allowing, the French to come back.
If Henry Wallace had stayed on the ticket instead of Truman, we might never have had a Cold War.
There's a what if. And I also, by the way, believe in what we sometimes dismiss as counterfactual analysis. There are lots of professional historians who will tell you it's a waste of time. We have enough difficulty deciding what did happen in history. But I think, in fact, it helps us better understand what did happen. It's not just a parlor game, because we can better understand what Johnson did in Vietnam if we speculate about what a surviving JFK might have done in Vietnam. It helps us better understand the real past.
So imagine where we are. In the bowels of the policy planning, deep state contemplation of the future, but then also the things that we, I hate to quote Rumsfeld, but the things that we don't know, we don't know.
Well, I would hope, and I guess I would imagine, that in the deep bowels, there is serious thinking by somebody, somewhere, about the rise of China, the gradual diminution in American power on the world stage, both in economic and military terms. What are the implications of this? What does it mean that India is growing so rapidly, at least in terms of its population?
What does it mean that France, even today, is having as raucous, ugly, populist,
yes,
and maybe liberating election as we've ever had.
Yeah. No,
this is a global fashion now.
It is. It is a global fashion. And also on the military side, that there is serious consideration being given to what the technological changes mean for the United States, of course, in particular. We're spending somewhere north of $800 billion on our military this year, if you include the sort of overseas contingency operations and other things.
Mm-hmm.
That's just an enormous amount. Meanwhile, the Chinese, you know, they're less than half, but they've been growing by double-digit figures every year for the last 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody better be thinking about what that means in structural terms. And then, of course, we also have to think about individuals and contingencies, the unexpected in history, unintended consequences, mm-hmm. which is another thing, by the way, that historical understanding, historical reasoning can help us appreciate.
Is that what you're crediting H.R. McMaster with, that kind of historical...
Yeah,
puzzlement,
I think he does have that. He's shown that in some of his writings, including Dereliction of Duty. I sense that from our own conversations together. But, you know, can you do this in office? Can you, when the pressure is on, say to the president, Mr. President, this is not what we need to be doing, and the historical reading tells us why we shouldn't be doing it.
It's so interesting. Frederick Logoval. Is our guest. Coming up, there's another general notion out there in a lot of people's bones, not just that the American superpower century, but the long reign of Europe and the Western Hemisphere are both winding down. Gideon Rachman of the Financial Times calls his version of the story Easternization. This is Open Source. Gideon Rachman of the Financial Times in London is a much smarter version of Tom Friedman in the New York Times, spends too much time in Davos, as I told him, but he listens carefully and he reports from all over the world. The underlying problem that we're fussing about, he says, is something he calls Easternization in a new book subtitled Asia's Rise and America's Decline. He told us this week that the pace of it all accelerated in the last 8 years on Barack Obama's watch.
One of the perhaps lasting significances of Obama's approach to foreign policy is that he's the first U.S. president that I can think of who says that Asia should be the central focus of American foreign policy. Not the Americas, not Europe, but Asia. And this is a policy that becomes known as the pivot to Asia.
Loosely translated as meaning, get me the hell out of the Middle East, please.
Yeah, there's a lot of that. I mean, I think Obama looks at the previous 8 years and says, look, we've spent blood and treasure in the Middle East, which has been a bit of a disaster, that it's not been a good investment of American energy because the Middle East is not going to be the area of the world that the future is determined in. But what the pivot actually means in practice changes when he comes in. I think he has a focus on transnational challenges such as climate change or financial stability that he can work with China on, that they should be a partnership, really. And that notion of a partnership over the course of his 8 years really deteriorates into something much more adversarial. In around 2012, China's leadership changes. Xi Jinping comes in Beijing, and that ushers in a more obviously assertive period in Chinese foreign policy. They become more confrontational towards Japan, and then in the last couple of years, they start building these islands in the South China Sea, which is there to reinforce their very controversial claims to this vast stretch of the Pacific Ocean. Now, why should America care about that? Well, I suppose that's where Hillary Clinton came in, because she, in a speech in 2010 when she was Secretary of State, said, much to the displeasure of the Chinese, that America has a national interest in the South China Sea. It's because 50% of the world's merchandise trade passes through this area. This is now paraphrasing her. We don't really want to see it become a Chinese lake. And when the Chinese start to really build up their resources there and begin to turn them into something like military bases, the Americans take fright, but they don't really know how to respond. So the Obama years end with the U.S. Navy sending these naval missions past the islands to kind of signify that they don't accept China's claims. But it looks a bit like China has established facts in the water. At that point, it's expected that Hillary will take over, but of course we know that she doesn't, and instead it's Donald Trump in the White House.
From the moon, the idea of the United States policing the South China Sea is about as sensible as the Chinese policing the Panama Canal. And it also sort of assumes that the Chinese don't know how to keep trade and shipping lanes open.
It's a very good question. I mean, I think talking to many American policymakers, they could come up with arguments for why they were doing it, but I did get the impression that it was something instinctive, essentially. As a German diplomat put it to me rather nicely, he said, when you speak to Kurt Campbell, who is the designer of the pivot, and he said, well, when you talk to Kurt about the South China Sea and he talks about the Chinese, it's almost like he's been physically challenged. You know, there was something, a kind of instinctive, you know, we're just going to push back because that's what we do. There was a British politician said to me, look, China's going to dominate the South China Sea ultimately. The clue is in the name. And some people do believe that.
Yeah, we keep noticing that. It is not the South California Sea.
Yeah, quite.
Gideon Ruckerman, you quote a Chinese diplomat, Fu Yui, friend of Henry Kissinger's, saying wonderfully, the U.S.-led world order is a suit that no longer fits. How do we take that in?
Well, that was an interesting remark because it was firstly a more direct challenge to the idea of the U.S.-led world order than many that China had issued before. In the past, the Chinese had tended to say, look, we don't pretend to global leadership. We're just what's kind of interested in trade and economics and so on. And here you have Fu Ying, a senior Chinese figure, saying, no, actually, you know what? We will want to make some changes. The world order was constructed by the Americans and the Europeans, and it is a suit that no longer fits. I think that now, in the Xi Jinping era, and perhaps because China has now become so large and powerful, there has been a rethinking in America. And maybe it's wrong to rethink. Maybe they should just say, well, actually, it's inevitable and that China just is going to be a major power and we should accept that. And maybe that's where America will end up. As I say, Trump is so volatile that, you know, one week he's going to confront China, the next he's talking about what a great guy Xi Jinping is. And maybe in a funny way, Trump's sort of wild oscillations in his attitudes to China reflects a genuine ambivalence in the United States about, well, how should we treat this? Should we regard it as a threat or should we regarded as in some ways a positive thing that we can live with. I don't think America's really resolved that argument in its own head.
That was the FT columnist Gideon Ruckerman in London this week. His book is called Easternization. Frederick Logewal, Pulitzer Prize historian of the U.S. in Asia in Vietnam time, is our guest. I learned a lot of different things from Gideon's
really
book, among other things, that Saudi Arabia now sells 2/3 of its oil to Asia, 8% to us. Also that the first female president of Brazil made her superpower debut in China, not in Washington. What do you make of Easternization?
Well, I think it's a powerful set of arguments that he lays out in this book, and I think it's really engagingly written. I think there's a lot to chew on here. It's a very intelligent book. I have some skepticism, I guess, about Easternization, some skepticism about its current power. It seems to me that it's not here now, and I myself am not sure we're going to see it anytime soon because, you know, we can speak of a West. I'm not sure we can speak of an East. I don't see the kind of cohesion in the East that would allow for an Easternization, if you will. And that's in part, it seems to me, because what made the West as powerful as it was had a lot to do with what my Harvard colleague Joe Nye calls soft power. It had a lot to do, it wasn't just about economic power or military power. It's about culture.
And it's rock about, and roll.
Yes.
Jazz, and movies.
And a lot of things that not only now, but it's hard to imagine in the near future, the Chinese perhaps in particular will be able to offer. But notwithstanding that, I think that Ruckerman in this book and this argument tells us a lot that is very important about how global power is, to a degree at least, even if not quite as much as he suggests, shifting.
Yeah, you know, it's glib and sort of pop. At the same time, it's also Tolstoy. And I was just thinking as you spoke, of Tolstoy in those long, late chapters talks about this, you know, this was an era when Paris came east, swept east on horses, and then got swept back by, believe it or not, the weather, by the snow, by climate, so to speak.
Yeah.
But again, we're talking about these grand, almost invisible undercurrents.
Yeah, and I guess I should maybe add, I'm perhaps shifting slightly on this, because I used to have a line, Chris, in which I said, do you notice how when the American president speaks, this would be in the Obama era, the world listens?
Maybe.
And when the Chinese president speaks, there just isn't the same kind of attention paid to this. This is beginning to shift. So maybe this is in support now of Rockman's argument. Now when Xi Jinping either travels or has an important announcement to make, there is a greater tendency for the world to say, wait a minute, this is something we need to pay attention to. I still think that Easternization, in the way that I understand he's making the argument, is a stretch.
Which brings us back to the pivot. I mean, I had the sense, he makes much of President Obama's pivot. I don't think most people even heard it. And the ones that did thought he's just covering up his embarrassment in Afghanistan or still in Iraq
I mean, as you said in your exchange with him, it was in part, you know, get me the hell out of the Middle East. I think there was substance to it in the sense that the Obama people realized we're talking here about a part of the world that has 3/5 of the world's population. It's about 4.5 billion people. And we have to reckon with this. And the coming decades in this century and then beyond, Asia is going to be extremely important. So on some level, it made sense. I have a pretty benign view of the pivot, in part because I don't think it was fully turned. It wasn't fully realized, I guess you could say. And again, as I think I suggested earlier, you have fundamental tranquility in the Sino-American relationship for Obama's years. I think it was a sense that you have to, in order to preserve American influence in that part of the world, we should engage in this pivot. And also it's something that our friends and allies in the region are wanting us to do. And by the way, this is an important difference between China and the United States. China has basically two allies. It has North Korea and it has Pakistan. The United States has either allies or friends still in all four corners of the globe. And the ones in Asia were important here in the Obama administration's calculations. So on some level, I guess I can see if I'm sitting there advising Barack Obama and he says, should we have a pivot? I can see the argument in favor.
Which all brings us to North Vietnam and this nuclear...
North Korea.
What did I say?
Vietnam.
I'm sorry. North Korea. Yeah. They're all so close together over there, you know.
Of course.
It's a serious headache.
Yeah.
Among other things, we're learning something about how those countries fit together and what they think of each other and who's afraid of what and who's watching whom. A lesson underway in how we might deal with such a thing. Where do we begin?
I think it's a really difficult issue. And here I will confess to you as a historian that on some level it seems to me that easy historical analogies are very hard to come by, maybe impossible to come by in this instance. I think we can learn certainly from history. In fact, I have several students in my class this semester who tomorrow they have a deadline for their course paper. And several of them are looking at this issue and looking at it in historical terms. So in a sense, I wish I had their papers here in front of me. I think that, you know, what's really difficult about this is that we've got a nuclear power that is developing the means to deliver those weapons by intercontinental ballistic missiles. In the meantime, through conventional means, they're capable of doing tremendous, unimaginable damage to Seoul and to other parts of that part of the world. And so it seems to me that America's military options are either limited or non-existent. And so you have to rely on the Chinese. That's North Korea's only real ally, and they're dependent on the Chinese. And yet they're also showing a willingness and an ability to ignore the Chinese when it suits their purposes, at least to a degree. So I think this is a very pesky problem. And I think one reason why you've seen President Trump, turn so nice to the Chinese is that he's been persuaded, perhaps by H.R. McMaster and others, that you've got to have, Mr. President, you've got to have the Chinese. We have got to rely on the Chinese in this particular crisis to have any hope of resolving this peacefully, hence this pivot, if you will, or change.
What about the history of this weapon that Steve Kinzer wrote about a week or so ago, short form, that the North Koreans got the weapon through Pakistan after in our war in Afghanistan, we eased up on Pakistan's restriction on nuclear weaponry, and they started retailing it where they could. And that's how this problem came from Pakistan, with a kind of wink from Washington to the nightmare moment.
Yeah, I'm familiar with the broad argument, Chris. I'm not able to speak with any kind of authority, and so maybe I shouldn't speak at all, to whether this is in fact an accurate summation on his part and your part here about what's occurred. I have no reason to doubt it. But whether that's why we're in the position we're in with respect to the North Korean weapon, I don't know.
But what if there is, in fact, a major reckoning with China about what it would be worth for us and the world for them to get very tough with their neighbor and old friend, their dependent North Korea?
Well, it's a really good question. And here again, I don't have a good answer for you.
That's kind of scale of history in the making.
Sure. And it may in fact be the case that that it's going to have to come to this. As I suggested earlier, I don't see an option myself, and I'm not an expert on the particular bilateral relationship by any means, or even the broader current geostrategic elements to this crisis. But I don't know enough about the bilateral relationship between the Chinese and the North Koreans to know what kind of leverage the Chinese still have and what they can do to potentially influence what the regime does.
Maybe we'll find out. Before we're done, I want to pick you up in your earlier line that individuals actually do make differences in history. It's not a secret, apparently, that you're working on a different, fresh biography of John Fitzgerald Kennedy. And I'm dying to know, what's the point you want to reveal about this man?
I am writing a biography of John F. Kennedy. I think what I'd like to do, I think it's a fascinating and it's an important life, and we have tremendous sources that I can utilize at the Kennedy Library, and I am utilizing. There have been important books written about him in the past. I do hope that I can contribute, obviously, my own interpretation to this. He is, to me, president at a key moment in 20th century history and in human history. I think what I also want to do in this book, Chris, is I want to use Kennedy to tell the story. Or let me put it this way. At the same time that I'm telling readers the story of John F. Kennedy's life and his family, his rise, his war years, he runs for Congress, he becomes president, I also want to tell the story of the rise of the United States. First, to great power status. He's born in 1917. In fact, we're coming up now on his 100th, the centennial of his birth.
Indeed.
He's born in 1917, right as the United States is entering that great power club, if you will, in a serious way. And then he dies in 1963, which by some measures is a kind of zenith of American power in the 20th century. So I think, and I hope, that I can tell readers that story. How is it that the United States becomes the greatest power in the history of the world? It happens really in his lifetime. And of course, it connects, it seems to me, to many of the things that you and I have discussed this evening that still are with us, that are still with us today. The other thing that I think John F. Kennedy speaks to us about, which is important to me at this particular moment, is his faith in public service, his call to public service, his belief that government can be a force for good in life. It won't solve all problems, but there's a commitment there to public service and to what we can do. And
even
of course,
as he switched on Vietnam. Yeah, it's an incredibly interesting subject. I think I've read all the Kennedy books.
Yeah.
My favorite might be James Douglas's JFK and the Unspeakable.
Yes.
That's a dark telling of the tale, but I can't wait for yours. Frederick Logewald, it's such a pleasure to have you on this program.
It's author been good to be here.
Choosing War and Embers of War. And JFK is the work in progress. Thank you. Thank you also
Pleasure.
To Gideon Ruckman and Graham Allison. There's more on our website, including a conversation with the China watcher Ian Johnson, speaking about a great awakening of Chinese religion in our time. Go to radioopensource.org, and while you're there, subscribe to our podcast and sign up for our newsletter, and think about making a donation. Our show is produced by Connor Gillies, Zach Goldhammer, Frank Horton, and Becca DiGregorio. Susan Coyne does our spectacular illustrations. George Hicks is our spectacular engineer. Mary McGrath is our executive producer. And I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time on Open Source.